We're talking today with our OSU wheat breeder, Dr. Brett Carver. Brett, you're showing off some of the work that you're doing right now and some varieties or various possible varieties that you're going to maybe eventually come up and release to the public. Tell me about some of the things you're looking for right now.
Of course, we're always looking for that better yield, and we want to continue upon the history of yield improvement that's already started. We have the latest varieties out there, Gallagher and Iba. We're looking to try to exceed those in terms of yielding ability, and I think we have some possibilities in hand. But we always have to check for other things. You know, first and foremost is quality. And some of these experimental lines that I'm showing today, they're here for that purpose, is to produce enough seed to go into commercial scale testing for milling and baking. In fact, two of them have already been through that process and won the Miller's Award from the Wheat Quality Council.
Now, you know, that's a balance, isn't it, as far as the agronomic traits versus the things that the consumer ultimately is going to want, right?
The consumer and the processor. And you know, I will talk about it at field days. I suspect that a lot of producers really don't want to hear about it, which is fine. But in terms of the breeding program, we have to meet certain expectations. And we're not going to cut those short one bit. And, may not be such that they can translate that to yield. That's okay. It translates to economy and the success of a product downstream from the field, and that's very important.
Tell me about a couple of them that maybe could be new variety that could be released fairly soon.
The one that we just keep coming back to, and we're going to have to make that final decision this year, is the OK09125, and this is the TAM303 Overly progeny. Combines the good characteristics of both of those varieties, particularly in terms of disease resistance, but also just broad adaptation and yielding ability. In Oklahoma, we have to think about grazing, and we want to make sure we can have that kind of adaptation, the ability to rebound from grazing, not so much necessarily the production of forage is good enough, but we want to concentrate on the ability to rebound from grazing and produce grain after grazing. This experimental line has that characteristic. It also has an uncanny ability to get around freezes that we've had over these years since we started testing it, and by its numbers since 2009.
I guess what this year, a good example of being able to really look hard at disease resistance or be able to handle the various rust because of the damp weather. Last year, of course, the drought stress.
Yeah, did we ever have a chance this year? It came in like we haven't seen in, well, since 2012, before that 2010, that being stripe rust. But let me back up and say one thing, and that's very important. Sometimes if we don't have the disease present, we have some other options we can bank on, and so we can go to the laboratory or we can go to another place where the disease is present, but we're more and more relying on the ability to predict disease resistance using genetic markers. And it's that capability that has allowed us to make progress, I think, on leaf rust and stripe rust, even though we didn't have those diseases since 2012, and we're going to keep using that technology.
Now, the technology that you're making mention of, a lot of folks are fearful of the GMO,
yeah.
But there's some things you can do that are not GMO that really give you a leg up, right?
Exactly, and it all goes back to the DNA and knowing what the DNA is telling us. For so long, we didn't know what it was telling us. For one thing, we didn't even know how to look at it. But now we know how to look at it. We know how to interpret what it's telling us, and we have such a better interpretation now, and that knowledge is growing exponentially every year. And some of the areas that we're growing is in learning how to interpret the DNA in terms of disease protection. That's so important. Sometimes we will use GM technology to verify what we're trying to predict using markers, and we have a beautiful case of that right now in Stillwater, an experiment in the field where Dr. Yan thought that, okay, if this gene is that important to protect against leaf rust, let's see if we can put this gene into a variety that doesn't have it. And not only that, put it in such a manner that it's a much better performing gene, much more efficiently processed gene in the plant. And lo and behold, it's really fascinating to see that that research going on. That's GM technology used in a different way. Of course, that's not going to go into the commercial grain stream, but it goes into our knowledge bank and helps us understand how these genes do their job.
And I guess what you've got several folks that can really do a lot of that basic research for you that that helps advance what you're trying to do out here in the field.
Exactly. And we have one of the best molecular geneticists all around. And Dr. Yan has a long history in using molecular genetics primarily in wheat. I mean, he knows wheat like no other molecular geneticist at a very basic level. Right. And I'm just so pleased that we have him. We're so pleased that we can honor him today with the Staff of Life Award from the Oklahoma Wheat Commission.
You know, looking forward, what is the future of programs like yours? In other words, are we going to be able to compete as far as publicly used or publicly sponsored wheat breeding programs for the next several years?
I think we can, and I certainly believe that, or else I wouldn't be doing it today. And one reason I think we can is the wheat improvement community still is pretty interactive, even between public and private sectors. There's still that networking, and there's still that exchange of ideas, and more importantly, exchange of germplasm that still goes on today. As long as we all have that equal and ready access to the germplasm, we can take that germplasm and use it to the advantage of the environment that we're trying to breed in. Of course, we all also have to have revenue. And the revenue is coming now from different sources when it didn't used to come from so many different sources. Mm-hmm. And that in part is due to the public or the private investment in wheat breeding. So I think that the future is pretty bright, and we certainly think so at Oklahoma State.
Message back to our wheat farmers. How would you describe to them the value of a wheat breeding program like you're involved with?
Oh, I wish I was more of an economist type thinker, and if I was, I could probably put a dollar figure on it, which I don't get too wrapped up in that, but I can see the benefit when we're taking a variety that's out in the field right now and raising that yield potential 5 bushels per acre. It's easy to do the math. You multiply the price times the number of bushels that are being increased from this year over last year, and it's and you know, the millions and millions of dollars that this kind of research generates is pretty mind-boggling. But let's not forget, it's not just one person that's behind this. This is a group, a network, and again, the network extends beyond the university, but within our university we have a cadre of faculty working together to do this. So it's not a one-man show or one-woman show by any means.